You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
You're listening to The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in association with the International Wine and Spirit Competition, using the best in the world to judge the best in the world.
Hello, I'm David Kermode. Welcome to The Drinking Hour from Food FM, episode 87, and it's the first of two special editions devoted to Bordeaux. This week, our focus is on its famous world-conquering red wines, made to a modern style. We'll hear from a dynamic new generation winemaker, and I shall take on the challenge of blending my own wine to be assessed by an expert, a winemaker. Plus, later on, a selection of Bordeaux medal winners from the IWSC in 2022.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
Bordeaux is the world's most celebrated wine region, rich in history and steeped in tradition. 85% of its output is red wine, and much is now being made of its modern style, somewhat lighter and fresher than before. So for the first of our special editions, we're focused on red. Bordeaux's winning blends have been replicated all over the world, yet it retains a je ne sais quoi as a region. So later on, I shall be making my own red blend, seeking the assessment of a leading winemaker who'll critique my efforts. But first, let's hear from one of the new generation of Bordelais. Quentin Vidal is the owner of Chateau Laurent in Franche, Côte de Bordeaux. Quentin, welcome to The Drinking Hour.
Thank you very much, David. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. First, before we talk about the wines, just introduce us to Chateau Laurent, the place.
Yes, of course. Chateau Laurent is a 10 hectares estate located in a Franche, Côte de Bordeaux appellation. So we are kind of very east in the Bordeaux appellation, not too far from Dordogne. You may be familiar with the Dordogne region. So it's a family winery. I live on the estate with my wife and my kids, and we have mainly red grape variety.
Yeah, okay. Well, Franche, the appellation, I must confess, was a new one for me. I'm familiar with the Côte de Bordeaux, obviously, and the amazing value, actually, that comes out of that that appellation. But tell us a little bit more about Franche itself. You mentioned it's in the east. Tell us a bit more.
Yes, absolutely. Franche, so basically, it's the continuation of Saint-Emilion and Castillon. So we have Castillon on the south, and Saint-Emilion on the west. So we are very close to Lussac Saint-Emilion, Puy-Seguin Saint-Emilion, and Montagne Saint-Emilion, which are the satellites of Saint-Emilion appellation. So it's really the continuation of the actual terroir. So we have a lot of clay, a lot of limestone, mainly a very hilly area. We have even more hill, I would say, than Saint-Emilion. Very much east, like I mentioned, so we are nearly continental, I would say. I mean, we are still maritime, obviously, because we are close to the ocean, but we have a much warmer, I think, summer and much cooler winter compared to the west side of Bordeaux, such as the Médoc. It's very small as well, as you mentioned. As you said, it's not really well known, which is true. It's 350 hectares, actually, so it's very tiny compared to other appellations.
I see. Well, that makes me feel a bit better for not having known about it. So it's reasonable to assume then that in quality terms, with that terroir, you're making wines that are very similar to the more expensive wines of Saint-Emilion, for example.
Yeah, I think, I mean, many properties are sharing a very similar terroir, relying really on the soil, really. So I think the main difference, and obviously we don't have the same money going into the winemaking process, I guess, compared to Saint-Emilion or Pomerol. And of course, Saint-Emilion and Pomerol have some unique terroirs that we don't have as well, clearly. but we are very close to it. And for a very long time, actually, it was considered as a whole region. It wasn't really that divided. So Franc vines were actually making Saint-Emilion wine for a very long time. It's only, I think, from 1960 or 1970 that the appellation system arrived and classified Franc as a unique region as well.
And the grape varieties that you are growing, we tend to think in shorthand terms of, you know, left bank Cabernet Sauvignon, right bank Merlot. I know it's more complicated than that. What are you growing there? What vines do you have?
So I do have Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon as well, which are two of the main grapes I'm growing. And I also have Cabernet Franc and Malbec. So we have four different grapes at the moment. I'm actually planting white as well. So a little bit of Sémillon we'll be planting next year. I really like Sémillon. The particularity actually of Franc as well is to be able to produce three different types of wine with the Franc Côte de Bordeaux appellation. We can do dry white, sweet white, and also red wine, which is quite rare in Bordeaux because most of the appellation in Bordeaux, you can really make only one type of wine. So we're actually quite flexible in Franc.
Interesting. What's also interesting is that you are in the process of converting to organic. What made you and your team want to do that?
I think it was, it became obvious, I would like to say, from my generation, without any offense to the older generation of winemaking people around. But we have much more knowledge nowadays of what's going on regarding farming and agriculture uses, let's say. So to us, it was clearly that if we were going to make wine here, it was going to be organic and none any other way. I understand, of course, that some people, it's not as easy for them to understand, but for us, we really wanted to get organic as soon as possible.
Do you notice the difference in the wines, do you think, with organic berries?
I mean, you do. It's not really about the actual product that you're going to use or not use. It's more the attention to details, how you're going to actually follow the cycle of the vines. In order to grow organic vines, you need to pay much more attention to your vines, pay much more attention to the signs that can indicate if your vine is doing well or not well, how you can help it. Obviously, if you're not organic, it's a bit easier because you have access to easier tools, basically, to fix it, let's say, if you want to fix your vines. While if you're organic, it takes a bit longer. So the better state your vine is, the easiest it is to make good quality grapes. And then technically, it's easier to make good quality wine if you have good grapes.
Yeah, and it used to be said that Bordeaux was a very difficult place because of that maritime influence, especially, to grow organic grapes. Is that really the case? Is that correct? Or is it something that just presents a challenge that you are prepared to take on?
I think it is correct. There's definitely easier places to make organic wines, such as obviously the south of France, if we're talking French wines, where you have much less rain, much less humidity. Which means that you have less chances to get fungus, clearly. So we're talking odium, black rot, mildew, which are the three big diseases that you could get in your vines. In Bordeaux, we get them every year. It doesn't matter if it's very dry. You still have a possibility of getting it because it's everywhere, because we have a very high degree of humidity. In the south of France, there's not much humidity, a lot of dry winds, so basically much easier to make organic wine. However, it's not because it's easier to make it down south that you cannot do it in Bordeaux. Some people have been organic for a very long time in Bordeaux. I think it's just about practices and adaptation as well. You need to adapt to your own climate.
Yeah. Tell me how you're doing that then. How are you adapting?
I guess it's a bit challenging nowadays because of the climate change, if I want to bring that subject on the table. But because every single year is going to be different. We can even see just from the last 2 years, for instance, which are totally opposite. In 2021, we got so much rain. Like, I think it was the wettest year ever in a long time in the region. And this year, it's actually the opposite. It was the driest year ever in the region. That's clearly the sign of the adaptation. Every year, you have to see how your vines are doing and follow as much as you can the weather forecast, plan your spraying and your pulverization, if we're talking hands-on work, obviously, like on your vineyards, and to be able to anticipate as much as you can what can happen to your vines. This year obviously was very easy because we barely got any rain. I spray the vine 6 times, which is very much nothing. Last year, it was about 12 or 13 times maybe I had to spray the vines. So every year is different, and it's really about adaptation more than ever with the climate change.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that you are really noticing, is it? Climate change, in the time that you have been involved in making wine, you've really seen the impact of climate change hands-on, have you?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. And on an everyday kind of, every year, let's say, every year scale, one of the easy things that you can notice is the fact of replanting. Like any farming, you need to replant your plant in order to get a crop. Obviously, the harvest every year, and sometimes you have vines that are dying, so you need to replace them. When we replace vines, we put younger vines, which are much more sensitive to drought or to illnesses, just mildew, for instance. So that climate change would have a big impact on that, and it's much harder to keep up to date with the new plant that you just planted. You need to be very cautious, and it's bringing even more attention and keeping an eye on your new plant to make sure they have enough water to survive, or if they don't, then they didn't get infected by too much mildew, for instance, for them to survive as well. That's one of the aspects. Anyway, of course, this year, for instance, drought, and I think it's probably going to be one of the big issues for the next years to come. And there are many ways to fight that as well. This year, for instance, I didn't trim some of my vines. It was kind of a try, obviously, because I've never done that before. Every year, normally, you trim the top of your vines in order to push the growth towards the grapes, and not the actual green vegetative area of the vines. But this year, it was so hot that I thought it would be good to actually give a bit more power to the leaves instead of the grapes to have less concentration. And actually, it worked out really well because I compared two different plots. So one plot where I did the trimming, one of the plots where I didn't trim. It was both Malbec, and I had a difference of 0.5 degree of alcohol at the end of the year, which is huge because this year the challenge was to balance the alcohol level with the acidity, basically. So the less alcohol you had, the better chance to save acidity you had. Without trimming, I saved acidity, and I had less worried about a higher degree of alcohol, basically.
Yeah, so you're adapting to the climate. You're also making the wines that people want these days, which is, you know, of course, lower alcohol, isn't it?
Exactly. That's a good point as well. Like you said, people tend to avoid very high alcohol degrees. I think people are going more of a healthy lifestyle, I suppose. So they don't want as much degrees in their bottle. It's kind of the opposite of what climate change is doing with the heat.
Indeed. Well, Bordeaux has an incredibly strong record on sustainability in terms of the take-up for HVE, the sustainability accreditation. In fact, I was talking to Stephen Brook, the acclaimed Bordeaux expert, about his new book, and he was telling us that he hasn't even listed the wineries that have that status, because it's kind of almost pointless, because so many people have adopted it that you don't even need to make a note of it now, which is a great thing for Bordeaux. Tell us what that HVE accreditation means that you have to do. What do you have to do to earn that status?
So what you have to do is basically do a lot of management. So record all aspects of changes and all things you're going to do in your winery, but also outside the winery. It can be linked to social aspects, moral aspect, technical aspect, economical, of course. But obviously, it's linked a lot about what you're going to do in your vine. So, for instance, how much product you use in a specific area and why, for what reason. It basically makes you think and take a step back from growing vines. And it mainly makes you think about why do you do it and how you could do it better, maybe, and how to improve it. So I think it's really linked, it's really similar to ISO certification to that stage. I think ISO is kind of the same thing. You kind of always aim to do better management, using less to do better. And I think that's what HVE really helps some farmers, really, or like me as well, to help how to run the winery more efficiently, I'd say.
Yeah, you must have to think about the use of water a lot. In the winery and in the vineyards now, I guess, especially with the climate change factors at play as well.
Water is a big thing, clearly. Actually, we did some work last year on our winery to cap all the rainfall that we get basically from the roof. And we have a big water tank underneath the winery that we can use for all the spreading, all the cleaning that we do outside in order to save water. And that's clearly linked to HVE as well. Basically, it's looking from a outside perspective, what you're using, how much you're using of it, and how you could save it, basically, how you could do the same with less.
Another thing you do that feels like a kind of thoroughly modern thing to do, I suppose, is you make your wines vegan certified, which means, for those listening wondering, you know, where the animal products come into a wine, of course this is to do with fining the wine in terms of clarification and fining. And you could use animal products or byproducts, but you choose not to. Why is that?
Well, in fairness, it's a lot linked to the commercial aspect, because obviously now it's the vegan movement, if you like to call it, because I guess it's, it's not only a trend. Obviously, there is a lot of vegan vegetarians and a lot of interest, let's say, behind that, which is great, I think, because we need more transparency. And in a winery, as you said, we actually use for a very long time protein-based fining products, such as pork base. It's often the gelatin that you find in the bone, basically, that often used for fining. Others, I mean, linked to fish as well, beef. You can use basically many byproducts from animals. But nowadays, with technology as well, there's a lot of products that you can that can be replaced instead of the animal one. So bentonite, for instance, is a typical fining agent that you would use, which is it's a stone kind of thing, bentonite. Pea, obviously, the pea protein, not only good to eat, the pea protein, it has a lot of protein, it's great for the body, but it's also great as a fining agent. So actually, all my reds, most of them anyway, are fine with pea protein. And I think it's great to avoid, if we can, to add any animal parts into the wine. I'm not vegan myself, but I would prefer to drink a vegan wine if I know that there's no animal product into the actual wine. Because isn't it wine just supposed to be fermented grape juice when you think about it? It's just supposed to be natural, and you don't really want animal part in it.
Yeah, no, it always amazes people who aren't involved in winemaking that there could be an animal byproduct anywhere near it. So you're absolutely right. It is just tapping into something that that is increasingly on people's minds, and it's a commercial consideration. It helps you sell your wine. So Bordeaux as a wine region is steeped in history and tradition. I mean, it is without doubt the most famous fine wine region in the world. Do you find it a dynamic and exciting place to make wine?
Yes, very, very much so. And I guess that's where I'm happy to be here as well, because I love the terroir, the region, the history behind it. There is so much going on between the different people working in the wine industry. Because it's not only, as you said, Bordeaux is really well known for the very fine wine, probably some of the best wine in the world. We have a very big reputation. But we are also a lot of people in the Bordeaux wine region. So it's a lot of challenge, but it's also a lot of fun to interact with all those people and to try to bring together Bordeaux as a wine region, but also as a unique identity, each of the region. Like me, for instance, or us, I mean, from the Franc-Côte de Bordeaux appellation. We are one of the appellations from the Bordeaux region, and we love to be able to interact with the Côte de Bordeaux, the other neighbors, such as Castillon, Bourg, Blaye, of course, all the classic Côte de Bordeaux region appellations. To have so many neighbors and be able to exchange information to help each other on the sales as well, I think it's great to be in a really dynamic environment, like you said. I think it's very dynamic, Bordeaux.
Yeah, great. I mean, people still tend to think, I think over here at least, about some of those very good, very expensive wines. You know, you're not far from Pomerol. You're not far from Saint-Emilion. That's just the right bank. Of course, we've got the left bank to think about as well. But we get these great names and these very high prices that go with those great names. How would you encourage people to think more about a wider range of Bordeaux wines? What would you say to them to encourage them to experiment?
I think try something new every day, let's say. I know it's it sometimes can be challenging when you are going to a dinner party and you want to bring a nice bottle of wines. Obviously, the easy choice is going to be to pick a Pomerol or Saint-Emilion, because you know that the person you give the bottle to is going to be impressed. But on the other hand, if you try something at probably a better value, and that you don't necessarily know, that's how you can come up to very good surprises as well. And I think all the Côte de Bordeaux, all the Entre-deux-Mers, for instance, and all the Graves and Pessac-Léognan appellations will offer probably a better price-quality ratio, I think, have so much potential and so much to show. So I think I would invite people to try on all this area. We are area where a lot is happening at the moment as well.
Yeah, I quite agree. Some of my happiest times have been spent in the Maison du Vin in Blaye, choosing wines that I didn't even know at the time, but I've just because the prices were so incredibly compelling, and I was never disappointed with the wines when I got them back home in the UK either. In the time that you've worked with wine, how have the wines of Bordeaux changed, do you think?
They changed a lot, I would say. But I think because, like any wine region, I don't think it's necessarily linked to Bordeaux. It's more linked to our society, I suppose, and the way we like, the way we taste and what we like. Because, of course, even if you make the best wine from your point of view, for instance, myself, if I make the best wine, and I think it is the best wine on the planet, you still need to sell it. So you need someone else to drink it. So you do need to follow the market and the trends. And Bordeaux has been very good to adapting to it as well. Over the years, Bordeaux have changed a lot and have evolved a lot. And even every year, I think there's new wines and new surprises to come up to. I think it changes a lot compared to the old days, clearly.
There's a greater emphasis on freshness, I think, as well, isn't there?
Yes, exactly. If we talk more about wine tasting itself, obviously, a long time ago, I think Bordeaux was using a lot of oak and using oak as oak barrels, for instance, as a typical vessel to hold the wine, to bring a bit more aromatic, of course, and to soften the tannins and to bring a bit more structure as well. Nowadays, I think Bordeaux is really focusing on more the grape variety and the terroir mix, meaning that you really want to reveal what each grape variety can do on each terroir. And that's where Bordeaux has a lot of potential because it's a pretty big region with a very diverse and very unique area, such as the Franc-Côte de Bordeaux that not many people know. And if you really show specific grapes on this specific type of terroir, it's just totally changed compared to what we used to do. And often it's towards the fruitiness, the softness, I suppose, something a bit more joyful, let's say velvety, compared to something more structured.
Which brings me neatly to your choice of fermenting vessels, because they're less conventional than other wineries. You've got some concrete, and you've got amphora as well. Tell us why you're using those different vessels.
I think, like I just said, I think those vessels are ideal to actually reveal the potential of a terroir without hiding too much the true potential of it. They are both neutral regarding the aromatic aspects, which means that concrete and amphoras, most of the amphora anyway, the one I have, are neutral regarding the aromatic, so they're not going to bring any other aromatics than the actual wine itself. So they won't be hiding any fruits, any spices, any complexity that you could get from your wine. And I think that's why I really focus on those. They are perfect to reveal the potential of a terroir.
Do you have a winemaking philosophy that you follow in making your wines?
It's a tough question, but I suppose what I try to do is more adapt. Okay, I think as I mentioned adaptation a few times already, but adaptation is key, and also it's also key to wine making, I think. So you really need to adapt to what you have. So basically at the end of the year, in September, October, when you harvest what you have brought back to the winery in order to make the wine, you have to adapt what you're going to make. I think back in the days, it was on the trend as well. We used to always make the same style, I think. Not only Bordeaux, wine in general, over France or even other wine producing countries. They tend to make a specific style linked to the region. Nowadays, first of all, it's more challenging to make it because every single year is different. And I think people are not necessarily looking for that anymore. I think people much prefer to have something new, something more interesting, something that's going to change every year. And that's why I think adaptations comes in nicely, because you need to adapt. And every year, depending on what you are getting, in your vines, in your vineyards, you're going to end up with something different in your tanks. Meaning it's going to be even more different year to year and on and on. And I think that's kind of my philosophy in trying not to mess too much with what you have in your vineyards, basically.
Sounds like a good philosophy to me. You make two wines currently, but your website says you have other wines in the pipeline. So tell us about what you do make and perhaps what you're planning to make as well.
So we do, as you said, we produce two wines at the moment. Wine focusing on the concrete aspects. So we only age in concrete tanks. So it's going to be mainly fruit driven, a bit more rich, but on the rich, fruity and riper side to the fruit. And we do a second wine, which is a little bit of oak and a little bit of amphora as well. So we still has the nice fruity and fruit-driven really structure, but also a layer of oak complexity to it. That's the two wines we produce at the moment. And now we are actually trying new things and adapting a little bit. Last year I did a little bit of Petit en Naturel, Petnat, some rosé Petnat, basically. I did some Blanc de Noir as well, so making white wine with red grapes. I think we need to try things, and last year was perfect for that. 2021, if you recall, was really wet everywhere. It was a pretty bad year for holidays, but only for also for farmers. So we had very low degree of alcohol, quite high acidity, and we harvested middle of October here, and we kind of had to harvest because it was a lot of mildew and a lot of botrytis as well, everywhere on our reds. So normally you don't really want botrytis on the reds. So I decided to harvest when it was time anyway. And you ended up having wine with quite high acidity, quite low alcohol level, and a lot of freshness, fruitiness, like beautiful wines, but clearly not really linked to the Bordeaux region. So I thought I would try a couple of experiments. That's why I make the Petit en Naturel and the Blanc de Noir. And yes, they're tasting beautifully now. I'm quite happy with that.
Exciting. I saw the pictures of your pet gnat on Instagram, and it's an amazing color for a start. It looks very, very inviting. Have you actually managed to taste it yet, or is it much too early for that?
No, it's really actually, and it's going to be very soon ready for sale. I only made about 700 bottles because Petit en Naturel, it's very hard, a lot of hard work, basically. Especially if you do everything by hand, which like I did anyway. It tastes beautifully. I left it on the lees for about 4 months and then disgorge it manually, take it off the yeast manually by opening the bottle, every single bottle, and putting back the capsule in it. And then let it age for another year, basically. So now it's ready to sell. It has, I think it's kind of a nice hybrid. It has a lot of fruitiness, a lot of juiciness, and you still get a good yeast flavor as well, like an autolysis. You could link it to champagne or more the traditional method to it as well. So I'm really happy with the try.
Yeah, sounds delicious. Final question then. What do you see as the future for Bordeaux? More adaptation and innovation, I guess.
Adaptation, innovation, clearly, are going to be the tools, I think, to reveal the terroir. Often Bordeaux, because I think we've been the first, like you mentioned, you're the first producing fine wines for a long time in the world, and very well known for that. And we are lucky to have such a reputation. But it also means that when you're number one in the fine wine region, it's also challenging, and you have other challenges, and it's never easy to last that long. So I think the innovation and the adaptation, we'll be able to reveal the terroir that we have. So many terroirs, so much complexity, and so many individuality, which kind of goes against, let's say, the overall Bordeaux picture, because it's so complex that you have many, many different small people making beautiful wines. And that's what's going to be the future, I think, of Bordeaux.
Great. Well, that's a very good place to leave it. Quentin, good luck with the winemaking and with the Pet Nat and selling that. I'm sure it'll go very rapidly. And
thank
you very much for joining us on The Drinking Hour.
Thanks a lot, David. No problem at all.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
You're listening to The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in association with the International Wine and Spirit Competition, using the best in the world to judge the best in the world.
Blending is an integral part of Bordeaux winemaking. Bordeaux is really the cradle of blends that have traveled the earth and conquered the rest of the wine world. Think
Cabernet Merlot, Semillon, Sauvignon. So today I'm at a Bordeaux wines blending workshop to explore the concept of blending and also have a go at making my own blend. I'm very much not a winemaker. I've never made a bottle of wine in my life, so that's going to be quite interesting. We're under the watchful eye of someone who's made very, very many bottles of wine over the years, Mathieu Huguet, and he's going to be keeping an eye on us and giving us the benefits of his wisdom as I make the inaugural bottle of Chateau Kermode, which I think we're probably going to expect a rush on the international markets for this when it's released. But anyway, let's not run before we can walk. So Mathieu, let's find out a bit more about blending. First of all, why is it so important in winemaking?
It's because it's a way for us, especially in Bordeaux, to highlight all the characteristics of the different grape varieties, and also at the same time highlighting all the specificities of the vintage and of the terroir, the soil, of course. Because you have to know that in an estate in Bordeaux, the soil are not homogeneous at all. So we, with empirism, we know how to plant, where to plant Merlot, where to plant Cabernet Sauvignon, to express at maximum all the characteristics of the different soil which are making the estate. So at the end, we really want to blend those different parts to together. Mm. And we do that like a painter. We mix the different colors we have on the glass, on the table, and with the objective to obtain the perfect color, in fact.
You said something really interesting earlier on when you were briefing us, that in blending, 1 + 1 = 3. What do you mean?
Yes, so I'm saying that with this formula that in fact the blending is not so simple. It's not a question of addition, it's a question of synergy. And at the end, the aim of the goal of the blending is to obtain a blend which is better than the best part of the blend. So the whole must be greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, it's a great expression, greater than the sum of its parts. And that's certainly true of the Bordeaux blends that I can think about. You also said something interesting, that we're so used to judging things by the nose in wine, but in blending terms, you shouldn't be led by the nose.
Right. Because it's so complicated. If we drive the blending session only by the nose, it's very complicated to anticipate how the nose will evolve. Does it evolve in a correct sense or in a bad sense? Will expressing flower or fruits? We don't know actually. So we pay more attention to the palate and the quality of the tannins.
Mm. And we're working with four of the approved Bordeaux red grape varieties. There are clearly more, but we're working with four today. And we're working with the most famous. So we're working with Merlot, we're working with Cabernet Sauvignon, we're working with Cabernet Franc, and we're also working with Carmenère, which is less well known in Bordeaux terms. Tell us what those four grape varieties, what they would bring to a blend.
So all those grape varieties have their own specificities, and they are here, and we have selected them to purely express the soil, the climate which is surrounding the parcel. So for instance, Merlot is very well adapted onto a clay and limestone soil. In comparison, it's better to implant Cabernet Sauvignon on the gravel soil, which is very drainy and not fresh compared to clay and limestone soil. So really want to adapt, and then we can appreciate that the result in fact is not the same. So if we speak about Merlot, we speak about roundness, we speak about suppleness too, and it's very expressive, demonstrative in a sense. And in comparison, I say that the Cabernet Sauvignon is the backbone of the blend because it gives powerful, and also it gives in the same time finesse and tannins too.
Mm. What about Cabernet Franc? Because that's my favorite grape variety, I think. But earlier on, you said when you were briefing us that Cabernet Sauvignon, which is one of my favorite grape varieties, is not necessarily a friend of Cabernet Franc.
Yes, correct. With the Cabernet Franc, I like Cabernet Franc too, because it's a good mediator between with Merlot, and it's a way to give more personality to the Merlot. Because of the climate change, Merlot is a little bit flabby in a sense. So with Cabernet Franc, it's possible for us to give freshness and personality to this Merlot, which is less and less acidic and maybe less delicate. So we pay more and more attention to the Cabernet Franc. And yes, I mentioned that Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc are not good friends at all. I don't know why exactly, but if you match Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc is sometimes is a little bit liquid, so it will reinforce the flows of the Cabernet Sauvignon in a sense. Mm. So it's not matching very well.
Yeah, interesting. And just finally, Carmenère. We're using that today. I'd go as far as to say that's one of my least favorite grape varieties. So why are we using that?
So we use that as a salt and pepper. It's a way to enhance to give personality to the final blend, in fact. So that's very hard to find the perfect tune when we speak about auxiliary grape varieties like Carmenère or Petit Verdot or Malbec. So we make a lot of trials to really find the right percentage. And if we get it, it's just fantastic. Mm. Speaking if we speak about a blending emotion.
Okay, well, I shall bear that in mind. I'll give Carmenère a fair hearing and use it as a seasoning. The salt and pepper you were talking about. So I'd like you to stick around, if that's all right, Mathieu, because I'm going to have a go, and then you're going to give me your verdict, an honest verdict on what you think of what I've come up with, along with Abby Bennington, who's here as well, who's a certified Bordeaux educator. So stick around, and let's see what I come up with my first Chateau Kermode. Okay, so here we go. I have four glasses in front of me, four jugs with different red wines in them, and a terrifyingly enormous pipette in front of me as well. And I'm going to taste these wines first. We have a Merlot first and foremost, so famously from the right bank primarily, and aromatic, fruity. It's kind of earthy note here as well, but very strident, kind of prune, plum, yeah, red cherry note as well. And that's definitely Merlot, real sort of signature there. These are all completed wines rather than samples from a barrel that we're dealing with here, just because it's easier to get completed monovarietal wines over here to the UK. So that's the first one, Merlot. The second is Cabernet Franc, one of my favourite grape varieties. This is gently spicy, kind of slightly earthy. There's some lovely floral notes there as well, which is one of the hallmarks of Cabernet Franc. And perhaps a little vegetal note there as well, like a tin of beans or something like that. But very pretty and really quite delicate, quite kind of a light frame for Cabernet Franc. The third, some would argue the king of Bordeaux, Cabernet Sauvignon, this left bank's signature grape variety. And this is quite ripe, actually. Black currant, slightly leafy, black cherry. It's a kind of granite kind of note to the nose, maybe stony kind of character. And on the palate, yeah, you've got this ripe fruit, quite assertive tannic structure there. Really, again, signature Cabernet Sauvignon. And then finally, we have Carmenère, which is An old grape that's made a comeback, most famous most recently in Chile, of course. And it's been introduced by Mathieu as a grape variety that is the salt and pepper, effectively the seasoning of any blend. And quite vegetal on the nose. Some dark fruit there, dark berry fruit. Quite muscular and quite assertive. And I think in my blend, this is going to take a very small role, very much a supporting role, if any role at all. I may, of course, decide not to use it. But yes, seasoning, potentially. So we have four different made wines, all representing these four different varieties. And I'm going to blend them together to produce my knockout blend. So that's the next stage. Right, so I have now completed my winning blend, and I kind of surprised myself, actually, because I didn't expect to use as much Merlot, and I may be expected to use more Cabernet Franc. But earlier on, we've got Cabernet Sauvignon in here as well, and earlier on, Mathieu warned us that Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc are cousins, but not necessarily friends, and that made me think, rather. And actually, as I've played with this particular blend, I've really surprised myself by favouring a greater level of Merlot than I was necessarily expecting. So in the end, my blend is 50% Merlot, 35% Cabernet Sauvignon, 10% Cabernet Franc. I think I expected to use a little more than that, but it's there for hopefully the freshness, and also 5% Carmenere. And at the beginning, I did wonder if I'd use Carmenere at all, but my experiments did suggest that actually, just as Mathieu said, salt and pepper as seasoning, it was a really useful blending partner. So I'm very happy with my finished bottle here, Chateau Kermode. We'll see very shortly what the experts make of my blending skills. Okay, so it's the judgment of Fitzrovia, because I have my completed blend. As I was explaining just now, I ended up using more Merlot than I thought I was going to do, just based on my trials, which I was quite surprised by. I thought I might go a bit Cabernet Sauvignon dominant, but I didn't in the end. I went 50% Merlot, 35 Cabernet Sauvignon, 10 Cabernet Franc, bearing in mind what you were saying earlier, Mathieu, about the Cabernet relationship there. And to my own surprise, I ended up putting 5% seasoning in there with the Carmenere. I wasn't sure I was going to, but I did. So I'm going to pour you each a little glass of this, see what you think. So I have Mathieu here with me, and I have Abby, a certified Bordeaux educator, and I've asked them to be completely honest and not be at all polite. Well, maybe slightly polite, but have a sniff and a taste and see what you think of the inaugural Chateau Kermode. So here we go.
Cheers, thank you.
So, yeah, well, you're welcome. Thank you. Well, I'm not going to give my own tasting note quite yet. Reasonably happy with this. But then it's not about what I think, really. It's about what our experts think here. So, first of all, Mathieu, what do you make of what I've come up with?
I'm surprised and happy that you learn very fast in terms of blend, because I have the sensation that your blend is already linked together. And I feel the part of the Merlot, which is a little bit grainy and not aggressive at all, and or you also feel some freshness, which is so important in Bordeaux blend. Congrats.
Oh, David. Wow. All right. Well, thank you very much. This man has not been paid to say this, by the way. I honestly did say Abby can pay testimony to this, that I asked you to be honest. So, Abby, what do you reckon? You don't have to be polite either.
I don't have to be polite, but I will be, because it deserves to be polite. I couldn't agree more with Mathieu. I'd like to find fault with it, but I can't. This is absolutely packed with those black and black rich fruits, really elegant, and I love the blueberries coming through from that Merlot. Really lovely, and that little backbone of tannins that you have, nicely judged.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, when I was saying to you, I was surprised by how much Merlot I'd used. You didn't look very surprised at all. You're obviously very familiar with these Bordeaux wines. So Merlot gets a kind of tough time sometimes as a grape variety. But actually, in the blend, it really is a massively useful ingredient, isn't it?
I think it comes into its own in a blend, and I think that's it's a much maligned grape variety when it's a single varietal, but when it works in harmony with these other varieties, I think it really does sing, and it is done in this glass. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Well, that was a really fascinating experiment. That is the first time I've ever blended a red wine. I've done it once with white, and maybe Chateau Kermode is going to take the world by storm. Let's see. But Abby, Mathieu, thank you very much indeed.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
You're listening to The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in association with the International Wine and Spirit Competition, using the best in the world to judge the best in the world.
Now, never mind my own efforts at winemaking, because it's time to round off with some genuine medal winners from the IWSC 2022 judging process. And today our focus is, of course, on the wines of Bordeaux. Let's kick off with a gold medal winner from right down in the south of the Bordeaux region, a sweet golden Sauterne. Marks & Spencer, L'Or du Ciron, 2018. In the category of 81 to 120 grams per litre of residual sugar, these wines are all about freshness and balance. John Hoskins, MW, was overseeing the judging, ratifying these gold medals. Here's what the judging panel had to say. An attractive and complex nose of dried pineapple, baked apple, golden sultanas, complemented by stone fruit, butterscotch and honeyed spices on the palate. A classic example of Sauterne with well-integrated oak. Sounds delicious. Well, here's a famous name, Baron Philippe de Rothschild Reserve Mouton Cadet Margaux 2020. This was a silver medal winner. It's majority Cabernet Sauvignon with 24% Merlot and 5% Petit Verdot. And here's the tasting note. An elegant and delicate wine with lifted floral, minty and blackberry compote aromas, refreshing acidity and a velvety texture. A classy wine, they said. There's a real push for rosé in Bordeaux right now. That style of wine sells so well. Here's a silver medal winning rosé from the region. André Lerton, Diane by Jacques Lerton, 2021. It won 91 points, getting it a silver medal. A blend of 48% Merlot, 44% Cabernet Sauvignon, the remainder a white grape, Semillon, playing the role, I suppose, that Roll does down in Provence. The panel said this, wonderfully elegant with floral aromatics and toasty white peach notes, leading to a complex layered palate of summer fruits, a touch of spice, and wonderfully fresh acidity. Next, a wine that featured when I joined Brad Horn to talk supermarket wines on his Instagram Live, Chateau Moulinet Pomerol 2016 from Aldi, part of their classic icons range. I just looked this up and it's $14.99 on promo. The regular price is $17.99 if you miss that promo. Not bad at all for a silver medal winning Pomerol. This is majority Merlot, of course. The judges said a delicate wine with lively red cherries, brambles and violet, balanced by earthy graphite, truffle and leather aromas with a long, warm finish. Sticking with the discounters, here's one from Lidl that also scooped a silver medal. Their Saint-Emilion Grand Cru 2019 won 90 points. The tasting note, an elegant, ripe, dark fruit-driven wine with vanilla, licorice, sweet spice and toast flavours, as well as supple and well-integrated tannins. I think this also retails around the £15 price point the last time I looked, proving if we needed evidence that there is value to be had from Bordeaux. And that's it for this special edition of The Drinking Hour brought to you with Wines of Bordeaux. Do join us again next time when our focus will be on the delicious and, in my humble opinion, criminally underrated white wines of Bordeaux. That's next time. Until then, it's goodbye.
The Drinking Hour on Food FM.
You're listening to The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in association with the International Wine and Spirit Competition, using the best in the world to judge the best in the world.